Uncle Floyd, how are you? How do you feel today?
Well, I got woken up at 5:25 a.m. and my phone for the next 5 hours didn't stop. But, you know, what can I say? He was good to me, very good to me. We had a relationship, and a lot of people know that. And he wrote the song, and he came to the bottom line to see me, and he'll be missed. I mean, you know, he was a one-of-a-kind act, an artist.
Hello, welcome. Welcome back, Bowie Persons, and a Happy New Year. And if you are listening today, David Bowie, happy birthday, old love, wherever you are. We're back for 2019 with this, the first in a two-part extravaganza, celebrating the mighty 2002 comeback album Heathen, 17 years old this year. Heathen is a marvellous major milestone in the Bowie canon. It marks his reunion with friend, collaborator and producer Tony Visconti, and together the pair came up with what the latter subsequently described as being Bowie's magnum opus. Certainly, this is a new era in Bowie's career, the warm, rich, mature sound, reflecting a warm, rich and mature man's outlook on life in uncertain times. Recorded around the time of his mother's death and his daughter's birth, as well as, of course, the 9/11 attacks, the songs on Heathen speak of faith, God, the future, fear, nostalgia, and cult television heroes. The album also features a bumper crop of covers, including some quite esoteric choices by the likes of Neil Young, the Pixies, and the legendary Stardust Cowboy. I think it's an album that easily matches the scope and richness of anything Bowie created before, and so in order to do it justice, I invited Nicholas Pegg back to the podcast, the esteemed and noble author of The Complete David Bowie, to cast his net far and wide in what became a truly epic odyssey through the record, hence this two-part edition. I'm going to take you straight into the heart of our Super Chat podcast straight away, but I should point out that, as usual, some sort of technical gremlin was present during the recording, and in this case, it affected my microphone in the first of this two-part episode, meaning that I'm a somewhat ghostly, echoing presence in the proceedings. Nevertheless, you get Nick Pegg in full surround sound stereo, and I think that's really the key thing here. So anyway, sit back, unwrap, unwind, and let us take you on a journey through one of David Bowie's most brilliant, accomplished, and enduring albums, Heathen. Nick, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's always lovely to join you for another Bowie chit-chat.
And I'm very happy that you're here. And we're actually not in our usual recording spot today, right? We're in a basement somewhere in Camberwell, which is a fairly long story, but if it sounds a little bit echoey, which hopefully doesn't sound too echoey, then that's why. But I actually have Nick Pegg trapped underground in a basement cellar, and he's not going to be allowed to leave. Until
this is where I say, Daddy, get me out of here. I'm underground.
No, this is where you have to spend the next hour pleading for your release.
Oh, okay.
Talking eloquently without deviation, hesitation, or repetition. Actually, maybe a little bit of repetition.
There's bound to be deviation. I can't do it without deviation.
As I said, there's not going to be any chance of that.
So not that sausage, not a chance. Yeah.
We are going to be talking even the 2002 album, which you were very excited about when we were chatting about this earlier. Very, very keen to do it. So, as usual, my first question to you is, Nick, why Heathen?
Well, I could say this about any one of David Bowie's albums, couldn't I? But it is a fascinating album. It comes at one of the real sort of milestones in his career. It is, I think we can look at Heathen now as we look in the context of David Bowie's whole career. It's the sort of beginning of what we might call his final phase, as it were, his last work. During the 1990s, during the 90s, he had produced some of the most vibrant, brilliant, experimental work of his career, albums like One Outside and Earthling, which, who knows, one day I'd love to come and talk about those as well, because I think they're very brilliant, still very underrated. But in the general critical sort of consensus of the day, he had become a bit of an acquired taste to a lot of people. He wasn't going to number one. For a lot of people, he was a sort of slightly peculiar. Some people thought he was past his sell-by date, this, that, and the other. It wasn't really until his headlining set at Glastonbury in 2000, when there was a sense suddenly that he was the sort of homecoming emperor of British rock music, and everyone sat up and took notice again. But Heathen was the one where nearly every single critic sat up and went, okay, he's back in the zone. He's got his mojo back. This is his big sort of comeback album. And it is, you know, and so I don't entirely agree with any of that, because I think that Outside and Earthling and some of those other albums are just brilliant in their own right. But there is a sense in which Heathen consolidates that period of post-Tin Machine experimentation. Of course, the most recent album that he'd released before that was in fact Ours, which is one I haven't mentioned yet, which was a much more, I think, a sort of a gentler album than Heathen. Right from the word go, Bowie, from his youngest days, Bowie had been singing songs about mortality and death, his own and others. But with Heathen, I think that's the point at where it becomes, you know, this is an album made by a 55-year-old man who is not looking death in the face, but he is becoming increasingly aware that, you know, the clock is ticking. And these themes suddenly come into focus and crystallise on this album in a way that they hadn't done before. And there's also the fact, of course, that Heathen was his first big reunion for many years with his producer, Tony Visconti, who had produced so many of his wonderful albums back in the late 60s and into the 70s, going up to Scary Monsters in 1980.
So that, in fact, was the last time they'd worked together.
Well, not quite. The last thing they did in that period was, in fact, the Baal EP. Was recorded end of 81, beginning of 82, at Hansa, last time he worked there. And that was the last time he worked with Tony Visconti in that long period. And then they had a bit of a sort of cooling off period in the 1980s and, you know, a little bit of a falling out. But they got back together and kissed and made up in the late 90s. They got back together in about 98, and they had actually already worked on a few bits and pieces already.
Yes.
Tony Visconti produced a track, which in the end was never released, but Yoko Ono was planning a John Lennon sort of tribute album. Tribute albums were all the thing in the 90s, weren't they? You know, where you'd get famous, you'd get the great and the good to do a song each. There was that Elton John one, and there was, you know, all sorts of one. And Bowie recorded a actually rather fantastic version of Mother, the Lennon song. Yeah, which has never been officially released. It was leaked. So, you know, you can probably find it somewhere on the internet. And rather fantastic. And Tony Visconti worked on that. And also on a track called Safe in This Sky Life, which was originally commissioned for, believe it or not, the Rugrats movie, if you remember the Rugrats, that which is the most peculiar collision of
things in Bowie's late career, from Labyrinth up to SpongeBob SquarePants,
right?
And then Rugrats.
Exactly, and that was recorded. But then, I mean, this in itself is a kind of an extraordinary illustration of the sort of fluctuating esteem in which Bowie seemed to be held. Unbelievably, they got Bowie to record a song. They got David Bowie to record a song for the Rugrats movie, and then they didn't use it. They cut it from the movie. I mean, what?
Have you heard? I mean, what?
Well, what is great? I mean, because the Safe was, in fact, it was reworked and re-recorded a bit, but they did. It was eventually released as a B-side during the Heathen period. So no, that's out there. But that was done in about 1998 as well. Yeah. They were getting back together gradually, and when Bowie finally said, "Right, I'm ready to do an album," he called up Tony Visconti. Of course, the other thing that we have to mention at this point is that in between Hours and Heathen, another truly extraordinary thing had happened, which was that Bowie had recorded another album, which his record label decided not to release. Incredible. What were they thinking of? This was David Bowie. And it was great as well, because we're talking about Toy, which was recorded in the summer and autumn of 2000, not long after the Glastonbury performance. Bowie got that band together, the live band who'd done the Glastonbury and the Bowie at the Beeb thing this a few days later, and they went into the studio and re-recorded a whole load of Bowie's Juvenilia, very, you know, junior songs from the early stage in his career. They blasted out and they sounded amazing. So he recorded a whole album of these and a couple of new songs which he'd written to go on it as well. This was originally going to be, you know, due for release in early 2001, something like that. And he was with Virgin EMI at the time. There was a, you know, and yeah, it gradually became apparent that there was a problem. You know, it was going to be released, and then it was off, and then it was on, and then it was. And anyway, basically, anyone's got to the bottom of it. But for whatever reason, Virgin / EMI decided they weren't going to release this album, and they, you know, put it on the shelf. Bowie had several years of already sort of hitting his head against the corporate.
EMI was really struggling at this time. Was this the Guy Hands period where they needed a hit album?
Yes, yes. And the whole business model of recorded music was, of course, changing because of downloads, because of iTunes, because of, massive things going on.
Bowie shows up with this album of 60s covers.
Yeah.
And so, of course, for the executives at that point, they must have been, what is this? Mm. What are you doing? You know, give us Let's Dance Again.
Yeah.
That refrain that goes through Bowie's career. Give us Young Americans Again. Give us Let's Dance Again.
Absolutely, yeah. But it wasn't as if Bowie hadn't had other label struggles in the 90s. I mean, his Outside album was, you know, the original version of that that he presented to his label. Apparently they took one look at that or one listen to that and said, what is this? And he went back in and recorded some more commercial tracks to go. So the eventual version of Outside. Yeah, some of the tracks on Outside were ones that he recorded to sort of just keep the label a bit happy. I mean, they're great. They're still great songs, but it was originally going to be a lot more wonky even than it was. I think at this stage, he'd had enough. It had come to a head that, you know, a major label refusing to release his new album. Obviously, he wasn't very happy about that at all. So this is the point at which he gave them the boot, formed his own label, which again is another thing that, you know, artists were starting to do at that point. So he created this new label called ISO, which was his own thing. And then he took it to Columbia Records and got a deal with them for distribution. So Heathen, which was recorded in summer and autumn of 2001, was the first album that came out on his own label. And he sort of had a great deal more sort of artistic and sort of marketing control over it than he'd ever had before, really, with his work.
Yes, I remember reading interviews with him at that point where he was incredibly acerbic about record labels. And I think this new lease of life he had with the record label, with that autonomy of what he was doing. And we have a number of different strands which all come together here. So we have the Visconti relationship firing again.
Yeah.
I read somewhere they were listening to, they were just getting together and listening to an awful lot of music at that point. I think Beck's Midnight Vultures was a big favourite. That relationship was rekindled. As you say, the label situation was resolved. And Bowie had a daughter.
Yes, indeed. He had just become a father, again, in the summer of 2000.
His daughter was born.
Yeah, very much so.
And then pulling the focus back a little bit, what you said about Ours is true. I think Ours does begin hints of nostalgia, maybe, or of, you know, taking a look back over a career.
Yes.
Whereas when we come to Heathen, my next question for you really is, the title. What is Heathen in this context?
Right. I think it is an awful lot of different things. It's not just, I mean, obviously the word heathen has religious connotations. Obviously that's the first thing to say. And from that we move on to, you know, wondering about what David Bowie's spiritual stroke faith situation was. And of course, you know, David Bowie throughout his life had a complex relationship with God. You know, he certainly wasn't a conventional church-going Christian, but he clearly did have some sort of belief. But it was a belief that he struggled with. And it was a belief that he found, I think, over his life, increasingly difficult to reconcile with what he saw around him. And you're quite right. With the album Heathen, I think it's incredibly important that he had just become a father again. This was tremendously affecting his songwriting, because whereas the Hours album, you know, there's a sense of, as you said, a sort of retrospective feeling, a sense of world weariness, and almost a sense of resignation on some of the songs. But Heathen, actually, I think a more troubled album than in you know, lyrically than Hours. But there's a sense of sort of nagging anxiety and fear for the future, and this sort of wayward spiritual search that you can see in his work right back to, you know, Station to Station is an obvious example, but many of it. So Heathen, he said so at the time. He said that he was thinking about his daughter, this new baby that he and Iman had brought into the world, and he was, you know, in fear for the future, for her future, for what the world was going to be. And, you know, so there's a sense on Heathen, there's this extraordinary tug of war between the sort of lust for life and his own sense of his own mortality and of all of our mortality. There's also, I think, a sense of shattered optimism. It's all very jolly, isn't it? But, you know, there was a time in the 1990s when, you know, again, looking on the Outside album and Earthling and things, there's a sense of looking forward to the millennium. There was a time when we all talked about the year 2000 as though it was some amazing sort of space age thing on the horizon, you know. And it came and it went. And I think by 2001, you know, Bowie was kind of feeling that it, you know, that sort of wonderful sense of optimism and promise hadn't materialized. Actually, on his next album, here goes a digression, on Reality, which came after Heathen, there's a song on there called She'll Drive the Big Car, which actually has a line about that. He sings, like, way back when Millennium meant racing to the light. You know, he's remembering that. Yeah. And so this all manifests itself big time on Heathen, I think. You know, he actually said, there's a little quote that he said at the time when he was talking about Heathen. He said, one of the themes of the album is, and here's the quote, the fear that there is no spiritual life. So, you know, he's wrestling with, you know, he doesn't know if, you know, when the end comes, that's it. Darkness, blackness, nothing, oblivion. And of course, we think about 2001 and we think about the, you know, events in the world as well. The other extraordinary thing, of course, Heathen didn't come out until the early summer of 2002. It was recorded sort of August, September, the main recording sessions, 2001. And by the time it came out, it was quite difficult to hear some of those songs, particularly perhaps the opening track, Sunday, and a few of the others, without thinking, well, 9/11. But the extraordinary thing is that the songs were written and largely recorded before 9/11 happened. So it wasn't about that thing. It wasn't a reaction to that thing, but it's extraordinary the way it sort of plucked out of the air. That it caught that nagging sense of something in the air. And there is a, you know, you could listen to, as I say, I think particularly perhaps the opening track, Sunday, and you could absolutely assume that this was a song about 9/11, which it isn't. But, you know, they were recording it when that happened. They were actually away in the studio recording it on the day that happened. But that's another fascinating part of the mix.
It really is, because, like you say, when it came out, I remember the first thing, because in those days, pretty much, it was still such a recent event that it coloured the discourse in omniscient. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
And so, of course, when Bowie comes out with this album, which is full of these brooding dark themes and reflections on mortality and very heavy spiritual questions. Of course, everybody's like, oh, it's this 9/11 album. But like you say, the writing had been completed.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the tracks, I mean, this was an album that was cut quite fast.
Yes, I mean, as ever with Bowie, there were a few overdub sessions that weeks or even months later, but the actual substance of the songs, certainly the writing, the demoing started early, you know, beginning of 2001, and the writing and so on. And by the time they went into the studio in the summer, it was, you know, ready to roll. So yeah, it was. But as you say, of course, post 9/11, everyone was kind of looking for these things. Yes. And I think Bowie said another thing in an interview around the time. He said, I do understand why people might think that, but actually, you could put out half a dozen of my albums just after 9/11, and people would think it's true, isn't it? I mean, if you put out Diamond Dogs just after. Or whatever.
I think this is, from what I've been reading, a big part of the album's texture and feel comes from the actual location where it was recorded.
Yes.
He discovered this fantastic complex near Woodstock.
That's right, up in the Catskill Mountains, a couple of hours' drive north of New York City.
I found this wonderful quote. He was talking about the first time he and Visconti went to check out this location. It's fairly close to Woodstock, Alair Studios.
Yeah.
And he told Interview Magazine, walking through the door, everything that my album should be about was galvanised for me in one focal point. I knew what the lyrics were already. They were all suddenly accumulated in my mind. So in other words, he's talking about some sort of epiphany that he had at the moment.
Yeah.
There's another quote from Visconti who mentions one morning he just was looking out of the huge plate glass windows and seeing a deer.
Yes, and across the reservoir and the mountains.
Deer, it was like a tableau, a deer, car in the background. He was overwhelmed by this. He was incredibly overwhelmed. So it certainly seemed to fire up some kind of inspiration deep within.
I think this is absolutely crucial. And again, you can look back across Bowie's career and see that this was something that happened quite often. Bowie was very affected by the environment around him, as any sensitive, receptive artist is. And there are, of course, it's easy with retrospect if we know where they were recorded to say all this, but I think you can tell, just as you can tell, you know, obviously one thinks of the Berlin albums, for example, I think you can tell that Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust were recorded in London. Yeah. I think, I mean, you can certainly tell that Station to Station was recorded in a haze of cocaine in LA in the mid-70s. By the same token, I think you can tell that there's a different sense to Heathen that, very unusually for Bowie, it was not recorded in an urban environment. Yeah. It was recorded in this sort of repurposed 1920s chalet hunting lodge up a mountain in the Catskills with amazing views across the mountain. But Bowie was very keen to point out at the time that it wasn't sort of pretty. It wasn't a sort of cute, you know. Yeah, it was bleak and you know, eagles circling overhead and you know, the extraordinary views, extraordinary sunrises and there's sort of something very almost sort of cleansing about it, but also something very sort of minimalist about it, which allowed him to really drill down into what he was writing. And interesting as well that he said that it's a sort of an album of two halves. Not like first half and second half, but sort of mixed things along the way. There are some very sort of heavy pieces in it, and then there are some lighter pieces, and we'll talk about this in due course, no doubt. But interesting that he said that a lot of the sort of slightly more heavyweight pieces, like Sunday and the title track, of course, Heathen the Raisin, I Would Be Your Slave, those sort of songs, the very sort of spiritual, troubled songs, were among the first to be written. And, you know, he got those down, and then, you know, after he'd sort of anchored the album, he could then sort of introduce a bit more colour and a bit more light and shade and different moods to the album as well. And, you know, some of the other songs came later.
So this album, I mean, if you strip away, for want of a better phrase, you know, the lighter material, we could have had those four songs as a sort of station-to-station stop.
Yeah, 5:15, The Angels Have Gone, that's another one. Please. Sunday, yeah, absolutely. Slow Burn, I suppose you could do that. But even that's a sort of bit more up-tempo. It's still, the lyric is quite bleak. Through the 90s, after Black Tie, White Noise anyway, he had pretty much abandoned his usual tradition of including a couple of cover versions on each album. Mm. Okay, there's no cover versions on Outside or on Earthling or on Hours, but on Heathen there are three cover versions, and they're great. They're great cover versions. They fit into the album very beautifully, and it really struck me, especially at the sort of halfway point on the album, that the sequencing is quite sort of dark, then light, then dark. You know, and the cover versions are a part of this. There's almost a sense of, well, that was quite a heavy one. Don't worry, here's a bit of fun. You know, then back to... But that's not to say that the cover versions are trivial.
For us, I mean, it's a very satisfying album. Even in the mixing stage, we regarded it as a success. It fulfilled all my expectations of what we could do together. Yet, it has a very signature style, I think. You can tell by listening to it that it was made by myself and Tony.
Okay, so let's actually now get into these songs. So Sunday, the opener. Now, when we left Hours, which was quite a straightforward, musically speaking, album, it was a sort of singer-songwritery album.
Yeah.
We're now in this clicking, bleeping landscape. The whole composition feels like it's an introduction. You know?
Yeah, it's immediately a lot more sort of minimalist than Hours, isn't it? There's a sort of lushness about Hours. It's got lots of layers. It's got lots of guitars and acoustic guitars and swashes of synthesizer things. Yeah, Sunday begins with this sort of bleeping, clickety synthesizers, and say, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore. Yes. Toto. I'd be surprised if Bowie sat down and said, right, I am now going to make an album of great weight and artistic worth. That wasn't the way he worked. But there is a sense right from the word go that this is a magnum opus.
I believe his contact actually said that afterwards. He said, this is Bowie's magnum opus.
Yeah, well, there we are, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Sunday. I never really answered your question about Heathen, did I? About the title Heathen. We can start coming back to it maybe now.
Because
Sunday is quite a loaded word, of course, isn't it? And you know, Bowie was brought up in a unremarkable but straightforward sort of 1950s, 1960s Christian English childhood, you know. So obviously...
Were his family particularly observant?
I don't think they were hugely observant. I think his mother came from a Catholic family, I think that's right. I'm not sure. Yeah. They went to church on Sundays, I think, and he did used to tell stories about it, you know, remembering hearing his mother listening to the service on the radio and things like that, you know, Over the Wings of a Dove, that song that so sort of influenced him and affected him and stuck in his mind. And of course, Sunday is in quite a lot of his early lyrics, and Can't Help Thinking About Me. He sings, remember when we used to go to church on Sunday. And in, again, a couple of other early songs, in Rubber Band and Love You Till Tuesday, both have lovers meeting on a Sunday. It could almost be like a diary entry, couldn't it? Yeah. It'd be like, Sunday, this is what I did. It has that sort of feel to it.
There's really been no room for change with me. It's all despondency, despair, fear, isolation.
Going back to your question about Heathen for a moment, about the title Heathen, I think it's not just about... He's not saying, I'm a heathen, I'm a heretic, I'm a non-believer, I'm a pagan, whatever. There's a sense of that. But there is also a sense of the, I think, the pejorative sense of heathen, you know, the way that you know, sort of people who are slightly more fundamental about their religion will refer to someone else as a heathen in a sort of aggressive sort of way. And I wonder if pointing that gun at himself a bit, you know, and saying, am I a heathen?
A take I have on it, because albums like on the tracks on Station Station, for example, he's grappling with this faith.
Yes.
And he's adopting stances in relationship to faith, to God, to spirituality. He's adopting various roles. And I thought this could be adopting the most radical stance towards faith, as in someone who rejects it. And I did think about, you know, the artwork and everything, you know, the blind eyes.
Yes.
The very deliberate artwork included in the CD booklet as well, the face.
This iconoclasm of original, genuine meaning of it, of sort of religious icons being defaced. Yeah.
If Heathen, in this case, is a mantle that he's adopting for himself and trying to analyse his complex relationship from that perspective.
And I think the sequencing of the album is terribly important like that. It's not just a random selection of songs.
No,
so Sunday is not the most heathen of songs, if you like, on Heathen, because later on, and we'll get to them, there are other songs where he's really actually haranguing God. On Sunday, he's You know, he is singing. I mean, there's a line, "All my trials, Lord, will be remembered." That's like something from Word on a Wing or something, isn't it? It's kind of, but it's almost, there is a sort of sense of, he's troubled. He's, you know, "All my trials will be remembered." He's almost saying, "I'm not going to forget this either. It's not just about you. It's just about me." And
he's using his Scott Walker voice.
And he's using his Scott Walker voice, that wonderful, as you say, sort of portentous voice. And also, I mean, you know, the musically, harmonically, and I mean, actually, melodically and harmonically, but particularly the harmonic progression in Sunday is something else. It's quite extraordinary. Actually foreshadows Black Star, the song Black Star, the monastic chants of the, you know, it does actually, that sort of measured pace. The opening sequence, the day of execution bit of Black Star, very similar. And it's got those wonderful sort of polychoral chanting, which is backing vocals, which Tony Visconti joined in on. Tony Visconti has a wonderful ability to sing two notes at the same time, which he learnt from some Tibetan master.
He was talking about this. It's a very, very difficult technique.
Yeah.
And he masters it, and you can hear it here.
Yeah. It's the most beautiful. It has a great beauty and a great sort of, and it gradually builds, and these chords resolve upwards into it. And you know, for one moment they're minor and troubled, and then suddenly the sun sort of comes out on them. That rise up as on wings, and suddenly it goes into a major key. Absolutely beautiful.
Nothing has changed, everything.
That happens right at the end, which again is the other. And you know, interesting thing. This wonderful studio that they were recording in up in the Catskills was a huge open space. The rooms that they were in, great big enormous rooms. And Tony Visconti and Bowie revived the famous Heroes microphone. Famous story about the three microphones with the gates. And at the end of Sunday, that's perhaps the most notable example of it on the album. You can hear it, that bit where at the end, because it's all been quite sort of measured and quite sort of controlled, and then suddenly at the end everything has changed, and it suddenly opens up and blasts
out. So
the
patent of Visconti.
Absolutely.
Opening up the mics and Bowie really letting rip.
It's an incredibly dramatic opening number. Remarkable.
Day in, day out,
it ain't day in, day out.
Sorry.
Whatever else it might be, it certainly ain't.
It really sets the tone. I mean, like you say, I think a lot of the themes that he revisits over the course of the album are packed into here, ready to be delved into.
Yes.
And as you mentioned earlier, he will offer a little bit of light relief compared to, because we now come next to one of his favourite bands.
Yes.
And a band that he was talking up for years and years and years, the Pixies. And what an interesting choice for Pixies cover.
It really is, isn't it?
The most obvious one, is it? The Pixies originally did Cactus in 88.
That's right, it's on their debut album, Surfer Rosa,
And another thing that's really interesting about this track is that Bowie plays everything himself, apart from the bass,
right,
which Visconti does. But this was kind of like that Diamond Dogs style.
Yeah, approach. I'm going to have a go at
and
the... Yeah.
I remember when I first heard this, I loved the clunkiness of it. And it wasn't until some time that I realised it. Because that's his only apparent recorded drum performance.
Is that right? Ever?
I think so.
Yeah? No, you're probably right. I ought to know this stuff. But no.
Let's
look in the complete David Bowie. It's available from all good bookstores. Yeah.
By the way. I think it is his only recorded four.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. It is, and of course this is deliberate. Bowie was under no illusions about his own virtuosity as a musician. He knew his abilities, and his abilities were considerable, of course. And he was, you know, there is no better vocalist than David Bowie. As we've talked about this before, he was an amazing vocal technician. He was a very nifty acoustic guitarist. He was a very, you know, and he was a pretty nifty electric guitarist when he put his hand to it. But the fact that he decided to do this was you know, it's as Eno would have said back in the days, you know, it was a strategy. Yeah. And so, yes, his cover version of Cactus on Heathen has this wonderful sort of garagey sound, this sort of deliberately sort of low tech, almost that Boys Keep Swinging thing of a sort of teenage boy in his bedroom, you know, doing it all himself. But yeah, as you say, he'd been bigging up the Pixies for years, around about the sort of Tin Machine time he started talking. In fact, Tin Machine covered another one, didn't they? They did Debaser on tour in the back in the second Tin Machine tour. And of course, Black Francis, the singer from the Pixies, had joined Bowie on stage at his 50th concert as well. They did Fashion and Scary Monsters together. So yes, this was a kind of culmination of that. Bowie had obviously admired them for a long time. It seems to, as so often with Bowie's cover versions, it sort of bends the album off in a funny direction, and yet at the same time fits perfectly within the album's scheme of things. It is almost a bit of light relief after Sunday, but it's not that, because it's not a particularly... It's a strong subject matter. It's quite, you know, it's almost a sort of tongue-in-cheek song, but at the same time, it's kind of, oh my goodness. I mean, I don't know if people know what it's about, but it's basically a narrator of the song is a prisoner, and he's writing a letter to his girlfriend or wife or whoever she is, saying, you know, I'm here, I'm all lonely without you. Take off your dress and send it to me so that I've got it. And then in the next thing, he sort of run outside and get it all sweaty and send it to me. And then eventually it's bloody your dress in the cactus tree.
It's kind of obsessive.
Yeah. Bloody your hands on the cactus tree, wipe it on your dress and send it to me. Yeah. It's got that sort of existential despair that is actually a keynote of this album. And it's it's right up Bowie Street, isn't it? That sort of weird, sort of quite bendy sort of song.
It's perfect for me. The whole thing's a blast. I mean, it's a very dark lyric, but like you said, there's a sort of slight tongue-in-cheekness to it.
Yeah.
There's a twisted, sick humour to it.
That's right.
It's like a little, it's so small and complete and perfect.
Yeah.
And yet, when he would play it live, then it's also got that little nod to Get It On.
Yeah, that's right. And the song is sort of the groover as well. It's a sort of T-Rex riff, isn't it? That da-da-da. And also, of course, adding to the tongue-in-cheekness, Bowie adds a little thing of his own to it, which is, again, like in T-Rex's The Groover, that begins with T-R-E-X. Yeah. In the middle bit of Bowie's version of Cactus, he outrageously, he does D-A-V-I-D and spells out his name. Yeah. Here's some trivia. That is only the third and I think last time that he name-checked himself in a song. Way back in, again, Can't Help Thinking About Me, keeps on coming up.
Hi, Dave.
And then, of course, in Teenage Wildlife, we have that bit about they'll come to me and say, David, what shall I say? Yeah, that's they wait for me in the hallway. I say, Ben, ask me, I don't know any hallways. It's one of the great lines of the band. So there we are. Can't Help Thinking About Me, Teenage Wildlife and Cactus, the three songs in which David Bowie calls himself David. Yeah.
Well, it's a really good song.
He really played up to that on stage when he played it live as well, Cactus. He sort of spelled it out with his hand. You know, he did kind of interpretive dance, sort of, you know, spelling them out, like doing almost the YMCA thing. brilliant.
This is WWHT, Newark, New Jersey, beginning another day of broadcasting.
The next one. Slip Away, I think, is really like the Life on Mars of Side One.
Yeah.
Now, for many years, I didn't have a clue what he was on about here. Because I grew up in the UK.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen...
The Uncle Floyd Show.
Uncle Floyd Show.
Yeah. Exactly. There's quite a bit to unpack here, so let's take it step by step. Yes, absolutely. First of all, let me say I agree with you. Slip Away is... If anyone doesn't know Heathen at all, and is, you know, listening to this and thinking, oh, I might have... Obviously, please, please listen to the whole album. But if you only listen to one track, pop on Slip Away. It's a stunner.
You don't need favourites, but if you do, exactly.
Absolutely. But no, in the hope that that one will win you over, and then you'll go, yes, right, I am going to listen to this album, because it's amazing. Before we get onto the whole Uncle Floyd thing, I guess the first thing we ought to say is that this is one of the two tracks on Heathen which were actually originally recorded for the unreleased Toy album. Now, Slip Away is a complete re-recording. It's not the version that was on that was going to be on Toy. Yes, and the song was originally called Uncle Floyd. But Bowie, obviously, you know, liked the song and wanted to do it again. So here it is. This is another object lesson in what's so utterly fantastic about David Bowie's songwriting method. It's a specific song about a very specific thing, which we'll talk about in a moment, but it also just takes flight from that and becomes a universal song about these feelings of alienation and loneliness and, you know, anxiety for the future and the past. And that. So, you know, it's extraordinary. You know, he can take something as small and strange and obscure as this, and it suddenly sort of blossoms into a song that means all things to all men. It's wonderful. It's one of his, I think it's one of the great songs of his late period.
From deep in the heart of Newark, New Jersey, with live inserts from Trenton, it's Uncle Floyd's Nostalgic Music Special.
So, the Uncle Floyd Show. It was a obscure, cheap, slightly naff children's... It was a cable network show that came out of various New Jersey networks. It ran for quite a long time. Started in the mid-70s, about 74. It ran up on and off, I think, up until about 1999. So it had only just recently come off the air for the last time. And it was... How to describe it is almost impossible, but if you think of a sort of a cross between, I don't know, the Banana Splits and Sesame Street and the Kenny Everett Show, it was a sort of, you know, it had a live audience, it had this guy, Floyd Vivino, who was a kind of old school entertainer in a funny blazer and a hat, and he had this sort of, there were various puppet characters in it, you know, including this little clown puppet called Oogie, who was a sort of a ventriloquist puppet, but Floyd Vivino was no ventriloquist, so they used to just cut to the puppet when he was talking, oh, shucks, Uncle Floyd, and then it would cut back to him saying, oh, what do you think, Oogie? And it was, and there was another puppet in it called Bones Boy, who was a skeleton. This is all, you know, referenced in the song. So Bowie, during the late 70s, it started becoming a bit of a cult favourite among... And it was kind of ostensibly a children's show, but it started becoming a... Yeah, absolutely. John Lennon turned Bowie onto it.
House husband, you know, hibernation in Dakota was obviously consuming an awful lot of television.
Yes. And I thought you were going to say something else there, but yes, he was it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
And but apparently, yes, he introduced Bowie.
Yeah, he introduced Bowie to it. And by this time, it was becoming a bit like the Kenny Everett Show. Bands right. were going on it. You know, Squeeze performed on it, Ramones performed on it, and things, people like that. And Bowie actually went along in, yeah. you know, incognito, but he did just turn up one day and sat in the audience, and the cast and crew were going, is that David Bowie? It is! And he knew all the words to the theme song and everything. And yeah, apparently he used to watch it, this is around about 1980, when he was doing The Elephant Man in New York, and he used to watch it in his dressing room, apparently, in the Elephant Man. So he was a big, big fan of it, and he loved it. And history of this show is quite interesting, and again, possibly, you know, germane to some specific stuff that Bowie sings in the lyric, because it was always on these obscure New Jersey networks, and was a bit of a cult thing. But in 1982, it had a brief period of national syndication. NBC, big broadcaster, picked it up and they put it out and it went nationwide for a very short period because then complaints started coming in. So what is this garbage?
And you know, when I was reading about this, I thought of all the people that Bowie's championed over the years from The Ledge, who we're going to come on to later. Drew Stardust Cowboy, Biff Rose... you know, all these kooky outsider eccentrics and Uncle Floyd.
Yeah.
Floyd Vino. Was very much one of these people.
Yeah, that's right.
Was
yeah,
a maverick.
Yeah, you know, Bowie always he loved these people. He loved, you know, the weirder, more obscure, the more out there, the more doing their own thing against all the odds. But he loved that. You know, the greater the ridicule bounced back at them, the better it was, as far as he was concerned. Yeah. He loved those people, and you know, and it wasn't an ironic. Oh, isn't this funny? This is so bad. It's good. He genuinely. Yeah.
But the NBC thing's funny because then they thought, okay, we can take this fruitcake and make him the next Sesame Street.
Or exactly.
You know,
or the next Muppet Show or something. Right. Yeah, that's right. But it didn't really work out like that. I mean, some people just said, what is this load of old rubbish? There were actually sort of complaints from the religious right because they had a character called Brother Billy Booper or something like that. So anyway, that it didn't last long. By 1983, it was back on cable in New Jersey and back to obscurity. So if you listen to the song, it's the what Bowie's singing about. Well, what I think he's singing about, but maybe I'm wrong. This is my interpretation, but we've said this many times before. You can interpret Bowie songs how you like. That's what they're for. That's what Bowie wanted them to be for. So I'll go ahead. Once a time, they really might have been Bones and Oogie on a silver screen. No one knew what they could do except for me and you. It's like it's our little secret. It's our little cult thing. But suddenly they're out there. And so he gets to that point of down in space. It's always 1982. The joke we always knew. So is he referring to that? What that could mean? What that could be suggesting, what it sort of suggests to me is that, you know, the opening of that film Contact, the Carl Sagan thing, was the camera pulls out from the earth and it goes out and you hear transmissions gradually and it coming out and you know, you hear the you know, things over there and then gradually goes to silence as we get far enough away from the earth that radio transmissions
are,
and the time factor, you know, the last, because and so perhaps, you know, what those NBC transmissions are shooting out into space and, you know, aliens might hear them eventually, but it's always 1982. I think there's something extraordinarily poignant about it. And it's just about these silly little puppets, you know, a really moving song. And he sings it, he's singing his heart out. It means something to him. And it was a belter live as well. He sang it on the Heathen tour and again on the reality tour 2003-04. It was a regular and it was a highlight, it was a favourite, a crowd favourite.
I saw
it several times in 2002 and on the reality tour later on. Yeah, and on the reality tour, he actually opened it with a clip from the Uncle Floyd show. They actually, you know, we were all there in great big arenas, thousands of us watching a clip of Oogie going, oh, say Uncle Floyd, what do you think of it? And then it went into, you know, and they did the song. When it got to the chorus, which it has this enormous chorus. It has a chorus the size of Asia. And Oogie's head went along a little bouncing ball with the lyrics on the screen behind it. We were all singing along. I mean, it was just, I mean, you know, that's corny, but that's all part of the sort of, it was just...
It hits the right spot.
It really does.
It gets that mixture of poignancy and tragicomedy and absurdity, which is this song.
Yes, yes.
And now imagine if, like me, you didn't have a clue about any of this when you first heard it.
Yes, you're going, what's this?
Again,
Twinkle, Twinkle, Uncle Floyd.
Yeah.
And of course, he's riffing on Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, because he then goes, how I wonder where you are. Now, here's an interesting thing, which we should mention at some point, so let's mention it now. As Bowie occasionally did, he didn't exactly fire his band, because, of course, they all got back together for live shows after that, but Heathen is an album recorded, as well, several others, you know, by a essentially quite a new band. Bowie was always very good at sort of staging an album, deciding what the personnel were going to be. He did it again, of course, famously with Black Star, didn't he? You know,
yes.
The next day, his big comeback album after many years, he by and large used people he'd used before, musicians he'd, you know, there are a few newcomers on the next day, but a lot of them were, you know, the familiar faces. Black Star, he got on, you know, apart from Tony Visconti, the core band was completely new people. And this is something he would do from time to time when he needed to shake up an album and get a new sound. And Heathen is one of these. So, yes, Mike Gelson and the rest of the gang, you know, Gaylan Dorsey and whoever came back to do it live. But if you look at the band on Heathen, it's largely new. Tony Visconti played bass on it, so he was, obviously a veteran. But, yes, this was the first time Bowie worked with Jerry Leonard, who did then become a live regular on it. Yeah, he actually, no, I beg your pardon, it's not the first time he worked with him. Jerry Leonard had worked with Bowie on the Toy Sessions just before. That was the first time. So anyway, he came back for Heathen. So it's his first big thing. Drummer Matt Chamberlain, he was a newcomer. David Torn, guitarist, it was David Torn who actually recommended these studios Bowie and Visconti. Yeah, he plays all those sort of ambient guitar sort of textures on it. And Christine Young on keyboards and backing vocals and various things. It was another newcomer. Catherine Russell, who went on to play live all the way through the reality tour with Bowie, a wonderful sort of percussionist, multi-instrumentalist, backing singer. And Bowie himself plays a lot on Heathen, of course. Perhaps the most important thing to say. And he plays a lot of retro synths. He got out some of his old things from the Berlin period, the EMS briefcase synthesizer appears. And of course, since we're on Slipaway, dragging it back to Slipaway, the famous Stylophone, which of course previously had featured on things like, most famously Space Oddity, but on some of the other early recordings as well. It's on some bits of The Man Who Sold the World, isn't it, as well? And in All My Mad Men? No, it's in a few others. But it's in After All, they're definitely on The Man Who Sold the World. And brilliantly, he took that on stage with him on the Heathen tour and the reality tour. Because at the very end of Slipaway, there is a Stylophone solo, effectively, right at the end. And, you know, they would end the song live with Bowie literally holding up his little Stylophone to the microphone and doing that little bit at the end of it. I mean, just extraordinary. Because the Stylophone, the Stylophone is almost another of these outsider artists that Bowie admired, isn't it? Because it's a ridiculous little electrode that makes a silly little buzzing sound, and kids played with it and everything.
It creates a machine that was an outsider machine. That's the Stylophone.
It's like the most low-tech, daft sort of proto-synthesizer you can imagine. And Bowie made something beautiful out of it.
What happened to David Torn? Because I love... You know, at the beginning of Slipaway, there are those beautiful harmonics.
Yes, those sort of picky...
Which kind of create this sort of, like, star...
They are, aren't they? Little twinkling sort of... Twinkle, twinkle, I guess. Exactly.
Why didn't he...
Well, he did. He's on The Next Day. No, he didn't tour with Bowie. No, he didn't. Right. No, but, you know, he plays extensively on The Next Day.
Slipaway...
So Slipaway. And you mentioned Life on Mars right at the beginning of talking about Slipaway. I mean, it really is. I think it really is in the tradition of Life on Mars. It is one of Bowie's great soaring ballads. It belongs in that sort of company. I really do think it does. Yeah.
It's got such a performance as well, the vocal performance.
Yeah.
As we mentioned earlier, he really means it. There isn't this shred of irony or...
No.
God, wasn't that crap.
Nothing of that.
It's fascinating to kind of speculate on why something like that meant so much. What was the almost the heartfelt, yearning vocal about this kooky cable TV show?
It's
tragic. But I think, like we were saying earlier, it's the tragedy of it. It's the adoration of someone's vision and their clear belief in themselves, despite ridicule, despite everything.
Yes.
And despite doing it all his own way. And... After you told me about Biff Rose, I went and had a massive Biff Rose.
Oh, did you? You had a Biffathon, did you?
I had a Biffathon, yes. I mean, on the last one we did together, which was the Hunky Epic, I listened to an awful lot of Biff Rose.
Biff Rose is another artist who's, pretty out there. And he's still pretty out there, that's right, yeah. And when Bowie covered these people, he often, he did give them a slightly more commercial sheen. We'll come on to this in a minute with the legendary Stardust Cowboy comes on later on the album. It's in a way an even more extreme case, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Bowie would sort of zhush them up and make them rather more, well, not conventional exactly, but he would put his own stamp on it and give a slightly more sort of glossy sheen to it. But if you go back and listen to the original Biff Roses or the original Legendary Stardust Cowboys, something else. Yeah.
That brings us on now to the next. This was actually the first single off the album, wasn't it? I remember seeing this on...
It was.
on Jonathan Ross or something.
That's right. It was originally slated to be released as a single in the UK. It never actually properly came out. It came out in Europe and in some other places, right. But in Britain it didn't actually in the end. They decided not to bother releasing it. It's an odd one, actually, because it was originally sort of launched as it were, the flagship single from the album. But then, apart from those few TV appearances, Bowie actually only performed it twice in concert. He did it at, Meltdown was his, we'll talk about Meltdown as well, of course, that this was... The release of Heathen coincided with Bowie curating the Meltdown Festival on the South Bank, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more in a minute. But yeah, that concert where he performed the whole of Heathen was the last time he ever played Slow Burn. I think quite a difficult song to play live. It has this very, very high vocal attack to it. It must have been a pretty difficult one to recreate live.
I'm not incredibly fond of this song. I find it a bit plodding.
Do you?
Yes.
I mean,
the vocal performance, take it as a vocal performance, is very impressive.
Yeah.
This is where we have Pete Townsend on guitar.
That's right. That's right.
Squalling, doing his like big thunderclouds of guitar.
Very scrunchy sort of. Yeah. I think it's actually it's a great guitar part. I think it's great. This came about, actually, this is part of Heathen that did kind of come about because of 9/11, insofar as in the wake of 9/11, Bowie was among the many artists who performed at the Concert for New York City, which is a big charity
America.
He did exactly. He opened the show. He played a beautiful version of Simon Garfunkel's America, and then he did, of course, the inevitable but fantastic Heroes. And anyway, Pete Townsend was playing at that as well, and they sort of met up backstage. Of course, Pete Townsend had played for Bowie before, way back on Scary Monsters. He'd played on Because You're Young. He plays the lead guitar on that. So they had a bit of history. And Bowie had covered I Can't Do. And much more recently, he'd covered Pictures of Lily, the Who song, for another of those tribute albums.
The Slow Burn is... I've listened to this now. It's expressly for this talk, I've made myself listen to it.
Yeah.
More than I would ordinarily listen to. And while I do like the kind of like big, stormy textures of Pete Townsend's guitar, I don't know, I can't really get into this.
It's the most sort of up-tempo, heavy song on Heathen. It is definitely, I think lyrically, it belongs with, Sunday and Heathen, those things. It is very doom-laden, here shall we live in this terrible town. And it is full of Bowie's sort of, actually some of his favourite sort of portentous phrases appear in it. I mean, he sings These Are the Days in it at one point. Now, These Are the Days is a little snippet that Bowie had used before, more than once. The line These Are the Days, of course, appears in Under Pressure. These Are the Days. And indeed on the song from Hours, the Dreamers also has it. So that's obviously a little signature phrase that he liked. It does have a sort of portentous, sort of doom-laden feel to it, isn't it? But perhaps even more interestingly, there's a foreshadowing of Black Star, because on Slow Burn he sings, and here are we at the centre of it all. And at the centre of it all, of course, is a repeated line in Black Star. So again, these little foreshadowings of things. It does have this very weighty sort of doom-laden atmosphere, this fear overhead. And I think it's a powerful song. I can understand why. I don't think it's the most distinctive song. It's in terms of just the music, the backing track, but it's a kind of a bit of a, like a Bowie standard, isn't it? It's got that sort of Heroes sort of and it's got, it actually does sound a bit like Heroes, a bit like Teenage Wildlife. Yeah, it's got that sort of groove. And it's perhaps less distinctive than some of them, but I think it's got a great power. It's wonderfully produced, wonderfully put together.
I totally agree on this apocalyptic feel to it. And of course, that's a constant over the years, isn't it? He's always revisiting this imminent, either existential, metaphysical apocalypse, or flat out annihilation. I mean,
those are the options.
Tracks like this, I think, do take on a retrospectively darker,
definitely,
texture to them. Had that not happened, or had it been released another time,
it might have
not quite had the same import.
Yes, I think you're right. I like the sonically and musically. It's got a wonderful oomph to it. It's got a wonderful. I love the bass line. I love the. I'll take the saxophones. You don't like the saxophones. I like the saxophones. You see. Oh no, I think those are great. I think it's a great bit of Visconti sort of discretion there. It's sort of uncluttered, but there are these little. Punctuation. I think they're wonderful. They are, by the way, those saxophonists are the Borneo horns, last heard on Never Let Me Down. They're a real blast from the past, blast from the 80s. Absolutely. Oh, I love it. I think it's got that wonderful. It's got more of a retro classic Bowie feel to it, I guess. So it's not the most out there track on Heathen, that's for sure. And I can sort of see why they chose it as the kind of flagship song, yeah, in a way, playing safe a little bit. But what would you have chosen? I don't know. I mean, maybe, well, I'd have chosen Slip Away because I think it's a masterpiece. But oh, Cactus, would you? Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's kind of like
yeah.
the song, like how song two was for Blur.
Yeah.
It was the second song on the album, and it was like a big, just simple yeah. stormer.
Yeah.
It worked. It's funny that you picked up on the brass because I am thinking, oh, that's so cheesy. It's like,
oh, I like it. I like a bit of cheese. I like it.
Oh, yeah. I like a bit of cheese. Well,
yeah. Oh, let me I'll tell you this. Right, this is the daftest. More, yeah, I've got more. I've got more.
This is a slow burn of a song.
I am now going to tell you the very daftest piece of Bowie trivia that even I have ever told you. Right. This is apropos of nothing, but I'm going to tell you anyway. If you arrange all of David Bowie's songs that he wrote in alphabetical order, as of course I did for my book, because my book has a big A to Z of all his songs, Slip Away and Slow Burn are the only two songs which not only are consecutive alphabetically in the entire list of David Bowie songs, but are actually consecutive on the same album. Slip Away followed by Slow Burn on Heathen. There you go. There's a fact.
And both songs are two words of four letters.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
If anyone's still listening to this podcast at this point,
and that wraps up part one of our Heathenathon, and I will have part two ready for you as soon as I possibly can, so stay seated if you are seated. Meanwhile, a huge thanks to Nick Pegg for his time and insights and generosity with his thoughts and reflections on Heathen, and as ever, a supersized thank you for you for listening. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please do share the love on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, or three, or just one. It's just at Album to Album. I really, really do appreciate that. So that's it for now, and part two is incoming soon.